Good morning. I want to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals. Thank you for being here today. It's my understanding that the attorneys are ready to make their arguments. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr. To my left is Justice Dana Womack, and I'm Bonnie Sutter, the Chief Justice of the Court. Before we take oral arguments, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call Stanley Rex Baldus versus the State of Texas, and may it please the court, Ms. Laura Zachariah to argue for the appellant, and Ms. Frederica Sargent to argue for the state.
Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court and the honorable justices of the Second Court of Appeals for the State of Texas. My name is Laura Nicole Zachariah, and I represent appellant Stanley Rex Baugus in this case. Mr. Baugus and myself both thank the court for giving your time to us today to present oral arguments on his case. I would like to spend a bulk of my time addressing appellant's point of error number two, which relates to the improper argument by the state at both guilt innocence and at punishment phases of trial. Appellant's point of error number two, however, intrinsically relates to appellant's point of error number one, which was the lack of evidence introduced in this case against Mr. Baugus, and may touch briefly on a few other point of errors if there's time. If it would please the court, I would like to start by first addressing the state's assertion in the briefing that error has been waived by appellant as to the improper argument. As far as preservation of error goes, it's appellant's position that under Adams v. State, 813 Southwest 2nd, 698, if argument is extreme, manifestly improper, violates a mandatory statute, or injects new facts harmful to the accused in a trial proceeding, arguments must be supported by the evidence and made in good faith. In Bautista v. State, 363 Southwest 3rd, 259, where there is a serious and continuing prosecutorial misconduct that undermines the reliability of the fact-finding process, resulting in a deprivation of fundamental fairness and due process of law, the defendant is entitled to a new trial even though few objections have been perfected. The comment must be harmful to the defendant and of such a nature as to suggest the impossibility of withdrawing the impression produced. Although in Cockrell v. State, there was a express overruling of prior case law regarding the requirement that an objection be made to preserve error regarding improper jury argument, Grotto v. State, 445 Southwest 3rd, 736, expressly recognizes that rights that are inherent in the proper functioning of our justice system cannot be waived by inaction alone. In fact, cases such as Adams v. State and Bautista v. State clearly establish that there is a level of improper jury argument that exceeds the bounds of fairness and is so extreme as to deprive the accused of a fair trial, amounting to fundamental error. So in this case, we do assert that there was fundamental error based off the prejudicial nature of the entire record and in light of the record as a whole when considering the amount of argument that was made and the improper nature that appellant asserts. In Brown v. State, 270 Southwest 3rd, 564, it is recognized that to determine whether appellant's substantial rights were affected, we balance the severity of the misconduct, therefore the prejudicial effect, against any curative measures and the certainty of the conviction absent the misconduct. To illustrate how Mr. Baugus' substantial rights were affected, the court must consider the record as a whole and consider the severity of the misconduct in this case. It is further asserted that even if the court finds that the alleged errors of misconduct have been waived, as asserted by the state, by the failure to object, it's our position that the prejudicial effect and the error are still relevant and go directly to appellant's point of error number four, that trial counsel's failure to object and preserve those errors is ineffective in this case. So we are presenting the harm analysis and the prejudicial effect of these arguments that were presented by the state for those purposes. In addition, it is appellant's contention in this case that the misconduct alleged against the prosecution amounted to improper argument on the basis that it was made in bad faith, thereby exceeding the legal bounds of improper argument as supported by the case of Adams v. State.
What evidence do you have, or what argument do you have to support your contention that it was made in bad faith?
So, Your Honors, the contention that it was made in bad faith revolves primarily around the allegations that were made in the state's opening argument, referring to the complainant's statements as consistent from day one was not only improper, it was a material misrepresentation of the facts. It was false. And that's what the evidence did, in fact, show. With a full review of the record, alleging that the complainant's statements were consistent from day one was known to the state, as reflected by their disclosure that was sent to trial counsel on January 7th of 2022, merely 3 days before this trial started. They disclosed that the complainant had actually recanted the primary allegation that she made in her SANE exam at the beginning of this case, which was that the primary issue was anal penetration or anal touching. And she recanted that a few days before trial started. And then to say that she was consistent from day one was a material misrepresentation of what she said throughout the course of the investigation, in the course of a 4.5 year wait for trial. In addition, another issue that appellant asserts was made in bad faith relates to his punishment hearing, in which the state advocated heavily that Mr. Bogus was not a proper candidate for probation. They argued that he couldn't be monitored, that his prescription history made him a continuing risk. And yet the record reflects that the state, in fact, offered him deferred probation on two different occasions during plea bargaining. They went from 10 years deferred to 5 years deferred. So our position is that the state thought he was probation eligible, not just probation eligible, but deferred probation eligible, non-conviction based at that time. So to turn around on the day of trial and represent to a jury that this man couldn't be monitored, this man who was on bond for 4.5 years without a single violation of his bond, isn't eligible or isn't capable of supervision, was again a material misrepresentation of even the state's own belief during the plea bargaining process. So to appellant to turn on that and to a jury of people who do not know the substantial facts as represented in appellant's brief argument four, because our assertion is that trial counsel did not put on a proper defense at punishment and committed ineffective assistance, which I submit on the basis of my brief, left him completely open. And that wasn't the only complaint. So as I briefly mentioned, in the state's opening argument, that's where this started. The state represented to the jury an open argument that Ms. Henson's statements were consistent from day one, and then in the same breath says that Mr. Bogus is untruthful with no invitation. No invitation from counsel. Counsel hasn't even spoken yet for defense. They call into question and call the defendant's statements untruthful. However, despite this material representation, the record is clear that there were massive inconsistencies by Ms. Henson's initial statement to the SANE examiner, where she indicated she was, quote, and I quote, screaming and pushing him off of her and then got up to leave. That was the statement provided to the SANE examiner. However, at trial, she testified in her statements that she was labored, she couldn't talk, and she could not move her arms. That was a direct inconsistency with her initial statements to the SANE examiner about how that unfolded. And it goes directly to the credibility and the statements of the complainant and whether she was, in fact, in a state consistent with her statement that she was drugged. And the state points out in their brief, at the time the complainant made this statement, she was not aware that she would test positive for any drugs in her system, as alleged by the state. So for her statements to change from the time that she found out that there was, in fact, some benzodiazepine in her system, and then all of a sudden she was labored, she couldn't move, but her initial statement revolved around pushing, screaming, getting the defendant off of her. That was a material inconsistency that the state misrepresented in oral or in opening arguments. But this was not the only time that the complainant modified her statements. The evidence available to the state in Dr. Johnson's pretrial disclosure shortly before trial, it indicated that a benzodiazepine would not make a drink, and I quote, fizzy. And this is what the complainant initially provided in her statement to Detective Hennard in this case. However, at trial, the complainant conveniently changed her testimony to coincide with Dr. Johnson's toxicologist report by representing that instead it was hazy now. That was a material change considering she was alleging that some kind of drug was placed into a drink that she testified she didn't drink anyway. And an additional very important inconsistency in this case by the complainant was regarding any contact to her vaginal area and her anal area, as I previously asserted. In her initial interview with the same examiner, she indicated that she did not recall, or with the detective, excuse me, she did not recall any anal penetration, but she indicated to the same examiner that she did not recall any vaginal contact, but definitely recalled anal contact and indicated she had pain in her anal area. However, in her statements to Detective Hennard, she indicated that she felt Mr. Bogus's penis touch her vaginal area. That was a complete inconsistency that were made at the time of the offense, closer to the offense. Coupled with the additional inconsistencies concerning the drinking and her alleged incapacitated state, and the fact that on January 7th, the complainant completely recanted her statement concerning anal contact, when that was the entire purpose of the SANE exam. And that was the only thing that the SANE examiner pointed out was there was a minimal amount of menstrual blood around her anal area, but no evidence of any contact to vaginal or anal area were found. No evidence of sexual assault were found by the SANE examiner. As a final note on this issue, the complainant was further inconsistent regarding her consumption of alcohol. The complainant testified that her prior DWI conviction, which was brought up during trial, was a result of a single shot and a mixture of Lexapro. However, the uncontroverted evidence shows that she was charged with DWI with a BAC above 0.15, and a Lexapro will not cause an increase in BAC, as shown in the motion for new trial. As the evidence deduced at trial showed, to obtain a BAC of 0.15, the complainant surely consumed more than one single shot at that time. She had a history of discounting her alcohol consumption, and this point is exceptionally important because of Dr. Johnson's testimony, who was the toxicologist presented by the state at trial, who testified that the mixture of alcohol and a benzodiazepine, which I mind to point out to the court that the testimony at trial showed that they did not know when this benzodiazepine was consumed. They couldn't have identified the specific type of benzodiazepine that was in her system, and the benzodiazepine was not found in her blood. It was only found in her urine. And according to Dr. Johnson, whether or not where the complainant would fall on the spectrum depends heavily on where her tolerance to alcohol. So despite these many complaints of material misrepresentations in her statements to the jury, and now they attempt to characterize them as a fair deduction from the evidence or a summation of the evidence, appellant respectfully disagrees. But the state did not stop there, Your Honors. In the same breath, the state begins their relentless attack of Mr. Bogus. He can't get his story straight because it just simply isn't the truth. This, coupled with my argument concerning the inconsistencies of the complainant and the state's material misrepresentation of fact, altered the minds of the jury. I'm running short on time, but I would really like to get to my arguments concerning punishment because I think they're extremely important to this case. In particular, the state's argument and closing argument at punishment where they alleged, and I quote, "This crime is one of those crimes. It's easy to think, or excuse me, you are not the second lower half of this crime. You are the upper half. You are what we are scared of. You are why our daughters and our mothers and our sisters and aunts have to think what's in their drink. You're the reason we have to make decisions about with friends. Will you watch me? Make sure is everything okay? Make sure I'm okay." I'm out of time, Your Honors. May I have briefly?
You have an extra minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is, he is the boogeyman. Let's not pretend that's not true. He is the boogeyman. Your Honors, the definition of a boogeyman is a monstrous imaginary figure used to threaten children or terrify our dreaded person or thing. Even if the state believed that Mr. Bogus was someone to be dreaded or is terrifying, this was not a proper argument. I would refer the court to the following cases briefly. Borhan v. State, 787 Southwest 2nd 53, where the court held that it was improper to refer to the defendant and direct anything at the defendant directly. In this case, this was not a general plea to the community. It was a direct attack on Mr. Bogus. And in Duran v. State, the court held that calling the defendant a punk was reversible error. And in Gilcrease v. State, 32 Southwest 37, 277, calling the defendant a bastard served no legitimate purpose and was considered substantially more inflammatory than any reference to alleged lies they intend to prove. In Jupe v. State, 217 Southwest 1041, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals denounced the state's attack by calling him a cowardly cur and reversed error. And I'm out of time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Would you add an extra minute to the state's argument, please?
May it please the court, Frederica Sargent for the state. In an attempt to, I guess, get around the clear waiver that we have here for counsel's failure to object, appellant says that the arguments were fundamentally a problem and is so prejudicial as to warrant reversal from this court. And she does so, or he does so, by pointing to the state's argument that Sabrina Henson, the victim in this case, was in fact inconsistent in her statements, and the state said she was consistent. This is a problem for the jury. Her credibility, the consistency in her stories, that was something for the jury to sort out. And the jury is told that they are the arbiters of the evidence, they are the fact finders. If there had been an objection, it would have been the jury will recall the evidence. So that argument fails right there. The second point that I would like to make is that the boogeyman reference, it was a single reference and in fact was a reasonable deduction from the evidence. The cases pointed to, cited to by appellant are from the 40s and 50s and have little or no bearing on this particular situation, I would think. A boogeyman is something to someone to be dreaded or feared, and in this case, the appellant was that person. He took advantage of Sabrina. She was in a very dark place at the time. He took advantage of her. She was young. He thought she was pretty. And he took advantage of her by inviting her over, getting to developing a somewhat of a relationship with her, smoking pot with her, making her feel better about her dark place. Her sister had just died, getting her through the dark time. And then he took further advantage of her, giving her drinks that were spiked, and then doing exactly what he'd been wanted to do all summer, which is clear from the way he talked to her and about her to her grandmother. So as a boogeyman, he is the boogeyman. But I would also say that in the totality of this record, it was a single reference. And a single reference can be disregarded, even if it is walking the line here. The case is fully supported by the evidence, by all of the evidence. It was a he said, she said. The jury clearly believed Sabrina and chose to disbelieve the appellant, and that is their right. That is their sole duty in this case. If the court has no other questions or no questions for me, I will stand on my brief after that.
What about the two arguments that were made, one about shopping for pills?
Yes, ma'am.
Where in the record is that supported?
That is in the punishment trial. His mother talks about his medical history pretty extensively and how they were going to doctor after doctor after doctor to get prescriptions for whatever anxiety medications after the car accident, I believe, and the injuries from the car accident.
Was that in the context of going to doctor after doctor at the same time, or going from one doctor and it not working to another doctor and it not working and another doctor and it not working?
It's not very clear how that shaped out, but it sounded like they were just going from doctor to doctor to doctor to perhaps get what they wanted or get more treatment. Or his mother did testify that he was highly anxious, shaking, I think she said. But as I said, it's unclear in the evidence exactly.
And what about the argument about the heavy bleeding? Is that supported in the record?
Yes. Sabrina testified specifically that she was menstruating at the time of this assault, and that she had a tampon in, and that all of a sudden she didn't have a tampon in. They explained that she testified that she was a heavy bleeder, and that if she had been walking around the house naked, as appellant asserts in his interview with police, there would be blood all over the place. And this is also, so you have her own testimony describing herself as a heavy bleeder, but you also have the fact that the morning after the assault, she goes home, she puts on fresh clothes, she puts in a fresh tampon.
Is that testified to?
Yes, and there are pictures. And she goes to talk to that's when she makes the decision to go to the Benbrook police. They took her clothes, and by the time she got from her house to the Benbrook police station, she had already bled through that tampon, and there are pictures of that on her pajamas that she was wearing when she went to the Benbrook police station. That's, I believe, there's a complaint about that. It states Exhibit 33 to 37, 35 to 37 are the total of the pictures. If there are no other questions, then
I have a question.
Sure.
What about the argument that the failure to object to that all of the argument of the opening statements and the closing arguments did amount to ineffective assistance of counsel, since there were no objections at all?
Sure. Well, the problem with that is that we had a full hearing on a motion for new trial in which appellant asserted ineffective assistance of counsel, did not specify how counsel was necessarily ineffective, but had a deposition and a full hearing to air out some of these issues. At no point was counsel asked about failing to object to any portion of the state's argument. So this is one of those situations where it probably would have been better developed on a state writ.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Okay, then I will give back my time. Thank you.
Hello.
Hello again, Your Honors. So I would just like to briefly address some of the state's case in rebuttal. I agree with the state. It was the jury's province to decide the credibility of the witnesses at this trial, 100%. That's what they're there for. They're our finders of fact. But the state took that away from them by commenting continuously on the fact that Mr. Bogus lied and Ms. Henson was telling the truth. They even attempted to elicit her credibility improperly, as alleged in our brief, through Detective Hennard, who had to get admonished by the court due to his lack of preparation and saying, I think, I believe. But the damage was done at that point. He straight told this jury that she was credible. He was not a reputation witness. He was not an opinion witness. He investigated a case in the span of an hour and a half, over 4.5 years with Ms. Kinson, and somehow he knows that she was being credible. It's his job to present the factual evidence, not to determine who was credible and who was not. That aside, the fact that the state believes that the boogeyman reference has little to no bearing on this case, I highly disagree, with all due respect. That was the last thing that this jury heard going back into that deliberation room. That was the last statement they heard, that he was a man to be feared, that he's the reasons we need to protect our mothers, our children, our aunts, when in actuality, the evidence didn't even establish he put anything in this woman's drink. The evidence established that we don't know what was drank. Neither party could identify that. It was a guessing game. By Detective Hennard's own testimony, he guessed. And the first probability that he sent over to Dr. Johnson, they replied that she would be dead. So the guessing game continued. Nobody knows. Sabrina Henson gave inconsistent statements as to whether or not she even remembered what happened that night. In her text messages or Facebook messages to the appellant's wife, she said, clearly, I remember everything. But now we get to trial and she was blacked out or unconscious, which it's our assertion that you can't even identify whether she was at a blacked out state or unconscious. There are videos that show her allegedly blacked out, that she's completely functioning, still drinking, still engaged in activity, which was one of the state's exhibits at trial. The state presented no evidence at sentencing to support that he was dreaded or feared. And I would like to address the pill issue. I believe that it was a highly prejudicial argument to relate that the defendant or the appellant, who is now prescribed some pills that he was prescribed in 2018, related nothing to this offense. This offense occurred in 2016, and the record clearly shows that they don't know what pill was used. That was testified to by Dr. Johnson. That was testified to by Detective Hennard. They could not identify the exact pill that was used. So to say that this is the exact pill that was used in this offense, that is creating a connection that, again, we represent was a material misrepresentation and deprived this man wholly of a fair sentencing hearing at a minimum. He was sentenced to 5 times the statutory minimum when his only criminal history was a marijuana case from his when he was 19 years old that, yes, he did fail probation for. But there are similar cases out there where a similar argument has been rejected, which is Keene v. State. In that case, the only evidence presented at sentencing was the fact that the defendant had a prior marijuana case. And he was sentenced to excessively more time, and no other evidence was presented. The state did not call a single punishment witness to represent that he was a danger to the community. So to represent him as a boogeyman, has our justice system fallen so far that instead of arguing the merits of our case, we have to resort to name-calling?
Okay, I've got a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it true that you did not develop post-verdict the ineffective assistance of counsel argument as regards to the waiver argument on the opening statements and the closing arguments?
I disagree. I explicitly asked Mr. Cleveland about whether or not he believed that was a fair representation of the defendant, and he specifically testified, no, I don't believe that was a fair representation of the defendant.
But did you probe into his failure to object?
I don't believe that we got specifically into his ability to object as to those, but I still urge this court that no objection would have cured the harm that amounted in this case. And regardless of whether he thinks he should and should not have objected, he clearly lied in his deposition, and I pointed that out in my brief on ineffective assistance. I'm out of time. Can I finish this statement briefly? He clearly provided material misrepresentations and what we believe was lies as to his preparation in this case, and State's Exhibits 62, 70, and 72 present that. 69, 70, and 71, excuse me. They represent that. He did not prepare for this case. He provided material misrepresentations that conflict with his deposition. So any amount of, this is the reason I didn't object, he should have objected. He should have objected at a minimum to get an instruction to this jury that calling the defendant a boogeyman was not proper argument. And he got sentenced to 10 years and a day. He is now away from his family, his 6-year-old son, his 13-year-old daughter for 10 years with no criminal history. No criminal history. And we stand on our brief that the facts of this case did not warrant that. And we pray that a careful consideration of that will represent and support our arguments, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the argument that was made. It's been helpful to the court. And your case is now submitted, and we are adjourned.